Rules and Elections Committee in a subcommittee format since we're short members at the moment. We will invite Ann Jones to come forward for testimony on the executive appointments. Ann has been appointed to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Tell us why you'd like to serve there.
Well, I'm very honored to be here. I'm currently a learning specialist in La Valla in an elementary school, and I have been teaching for 31 years. I have been in the classroom as a classroom teacher. I've been an assistant professor at a college. I'm a learning specialist and a reading teacher. And I have been very interested and involved in teacher standards and practices from the mid-1970s and have been interested in what they do. At that time, I was an assistant professor at Oregon College of Education, which is now Western Oregon. And I was on the other side as the college made changes because of what teacher standards and practices was recommending. And so I was interested in the process and what the committee and the commission does. And then during the 90s, I have been the state vice president of Oregon Education Association, and we have worked very closely with the commission to create some changes and revisions in the licensure so that it better matches education reform, and also to work on professional development as a requirement for staff around the state. So I believe my background as a classroom teacher and a college professor and a statewide leader prepare me to do a good job, and I really am excited about being involved in this commission.
Any questions for Ann? Anyone else care to testify? If not? Well, thank you very much, Ann.
Thank you.
We're going to close the hearing and open the work session. Senator Courtney, would accept the motion. You have it over here?
I'm trying to find how I would. Mr. Chair, I move the appointment of Ann Jones, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, to the floor of recommendation that appointee conforms.
Senator Tarno has moved the appointment of Ann Jones to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to the floor with recommendation that appointment be confirmed. Any discussion? Not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Tarno.
Aye.
Senator Scott.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the appointment of Ann Jones, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, moved to the floor with the recommendation the appointment be approved. Yeah. Carrier?
I'll do it.
Senator Courtney will
know. I may get beat.
I doubt that. And open a possible reconsideration on the House Bill 2713. What's the motion here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we passed House Bill 2713 out last week, and when we tried to drop the bill, there were conflicts with another bill. So we just have conflict amendments, maybe the -1 amendments. So we'll need to amend the rules and reconsider and
the quorum. And
we need not a quorum, but a super quorum. We need one more member. We need the. We're going to stand at ease for a moment, see if we can get another member in here. We're back from recess. Got a fuller committee now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, House Bill 2713 is the bill that attacks home sites on wildlife habitats, similarly to farm and forest land home sites in Oregon. And we passed this bill out last week when we dropped it. Conflict had arisen with Senate Bill 248, so we need to suspend the rules and reconsider the vote and adopt the Dash 1 amendment.
What is the thing?
Okay.
We need the reconsideration.
Mr. Chair, I move the rule be suspended for purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2713.
You hear the committee report it when I do this? Please, before I do anything.
Senator Tarno has moved that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2713.
Oh.
Any discussion? What
objection.
No objections. No objections.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we moved House Bill 2713.
Before
we do pass recommendation.
Senator Tarno has moved that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2713 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? There are none. Full order.
The bill before the committee, right?
Yes. We'll look out before us if somebody would like to move the amendment.
Mr. Chair, that's the Dash 1.
Okay.
Move the Dash 1's amendment to House Bill 2713.
Senator Tarno has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2713. Discussion? Any objection? Order.
Chair, I'll move House Bill 2713 as a floor due pass recommendation.
Senator Tarno has moved House Bill 2713 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Tarno.
Aye.
Senator
Cornyn.
Yes.
Aye. Senator
Tarno. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2713 moves forward to due pass recommendation. Senator Courtney, you want to carry that again?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, sir. Senator Courtney will carry. We're going to open a possible reconsideration work session for House Bill 3556.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 3556.
Senator Tarno has moved that we suspend the rules for this for purposes of reconsideration of House Bill 3556. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee reconsider the motion by which House Bill 3556 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Tarno has move that we reconsider the vote by which the amended House Bill 3556 was sent to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Committee Administrator, tell us what we've got in front of us now.
First, our members of the committee, House Bill 3556 is related to requiring persons conducting mechanical repairs on elevators to be licensed by DCBS. We passed out the Dash 4, Dash A4 amendment. Before they reached the desk, we found out that there was a conflict with those, and we have the Dash A5, which resolved that conflict and clarify that people who are already doing that work are grandfathered into this bill. Since then, actually this morning, we've also received the -A6 and -A7 amendments that continue to amend the bill. And we have Sober and John Gervais to give you a little explanation of what's going on. We have a couple options. We could either constructionally amend an amendment, or we could go back to legislation and amend an amendment.
Please, just laying how we got here.
You know, I'm not sure I even know where the hell I am. Pardon the language. Mr. Chair. Respectfully.
Why am I here?
Can I go home?
We can take care of it that way.
Yes. I thank the committee for their indulgence and perseverance in this and allowing us to correct a mistake that was made that by the council we didn't catch at the time. The -5 amendments, if you turn to page 3, we'd like you to consider a conceptual amendment, line 5 and 6. The sub 3 license is a person that has not received the training to do the electrical work in a plant, that the kind of voltage and technicality. And we made a mistake in including that. All parties are agreed that with the -5, with the conceptual amendment of taking out line 5 and 6, we've got a groundbreaking bill that will move us forward and give us an opportunity to probably pass a law that doesn't not letting law get in the way of the people.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer, and I'd just like to officially disavow any knowledge of -6 or -7. The department's in agreement with the conceptual amendment, and again, appreciates the committee's indulgence in bringing this bill back so that we could fix what would have been a real problem with the bill as it went out originally.
Questions?
How was that? Interrupted reading a note, and I missed the first part of your testimony. You mentioned that 6 and 7, those amendments are needed.
Mr. Chairman, that comment was somewhat tongue-in-cheek. I just wanted to disavow any knowledge of the 6 or 7. Or
I see. Okay.
I didn't know how I asked for them either.
I apologize for that attempt at humor.
All right. Well, I it went right by me. So I appreciate you for helping me understand that. So, I would, the chair would accept a conceptual amendment to the amendment.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I will move that we delete lines 5 and 6 on page 3 of the -5 proposed amendment.
Any objection? Hearing none, for order.
Move the amendment.
Move the -5 as amended.
Senator Tarno moves the -5 amendments to House Bill 3556. Any objection? Hearing none, for order.
Do we need the A6? We don't need the other two.
No.
Okay.
What's that?
Mr. Starr, members of the committee, since you have conceptually amended the -A5 amendment, you do not need the -A6 nor the -7.
No, we don't need it now.
Seven amendments. Those are now incorporated into the -A5.
Six and seven came out totally different than requested. We just didn't even recognize them.
Need a motion to move the bill?
Move, Mr. Chair, as amended with 4 defense recommendations.
Senator Tarno has moved House Bill 3556 for the defense recommendation. Question, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Tarno.
Aye.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Shannon.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 3556 moves forward to do past recommendations.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank the committee for your patience and your kindness and graciousness.
Carrier. Oh, Chair. Senator Tarno will carry. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2520. That's I'd throw your small would you I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Would you prefer to?
No.
Why is she here?
Chairman Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Our membership includes about 230 independent pharmacies, and that's the substance of what I'm here to talk about today with the A4 amendments, which entirely replace House Bill 2520 as passed by the House. I'll summarize my testimony. I'm cognizant of the time that you'll need to spend on 2700. The A4s address a business and consumer problem of marketers of pharmacy discount cards offering to take some dollars a month, $8 to $10 a month from consumers in exchange for offering substantial discounts at pharmacies. The problem is these companies don't go and get agreements with pharmacies that they advertise as offering the discounts. And this it basically means that the consumer is paying for something that they aren't really going to get. And the pharmacy is presented with a really big customer relations problem when a person comes in and presents the card. They're expecting to get a discount. The pharmacy's not really prepared to offer it. And so the A4 amendments address this by doing a couple of things. One, it requires these folks to identify on the cards that they distribute. And if you look in Section 1 of the 84s, they note that these are not insurance cards, that that's a benefit to the consumer and to the pharmacy. The pharmacies, as you know, use cards for point-of-sale determination of eligibility for insurance benefits, and they'll just quickly identify to the pharmacist that this is not a PBM card or pharmacy benefit management card. But the main thing it requires is that these companies actually get a contract with the pharmacy before they advertise that that pharmacy is offering the discount. And then Section 2 provides for cause of civil action and penalties. And I want to spend a little bit of time on Section 4, as this is very important. This is the people who are not included in the scope of the bill. So we want to be clear that we are not trying to affect any insurance plan, HMO plan, anything of that nature and that's part of the ordinary course of business in pharmacy and in healthcare. Section 4 specifically says that card used by a health insurer, an HMO, or a healthcare service contractor would be affected. Also, no benefits administered by the state. That would be OMAP, for example, or store club discount cards. Specific examples would include things like the pharmacy benefit card used for Kaiser's HMO, Providence Health Plans and Providence Health System has something called the Providence Plus card, which provides discounts specifically at AARP Pharmacy and Safeway. They have contracts with those pharmacies, they would be exempt because that's a benefit administered by a health insurer or healthcare service contractor. Self-insurance plans that are administered by a health insurer is a common kind of arrangement, also would be exempt. The Safeway Club card that I use when I go to buy groceries, that's not what we're after. That's specifically exempted. A card used by a health insurance for a health insurance policy, either group or individual, such as the PCS card, is a very common one. That's the point of sale determination of coverage of benefits. Those types of things specifically are exempted. What we are left with then is these folks who advertise on late night TV and through direct mail and primarily target senior citizens, who are the bulk of the cash pay population for pharmacy. They would then have to actually get agreements with the pharmacies that they're advertising as offering the discount. We've adapted this language from an Arkansas statute, which is the latest of several state laws that have passed in the last year or two to deal with this specific problem that has been prevalent out east and has arrived here in Oregon quite recently and was brought to our attention by our members. And we believe this would also then provide, although these types of practices, we believe, are already covered under unfair trade practices, this would provide some clarity that this specific practice is not something that's a legitimate business practice, and they have to mind their P's and Q's, and it would provide the AG with some authority to get these people to comply. There is one slight change. It was a drafting oversight in page 1 at line 17. The AG has suggested, and I certainly would concur, that the Attorney General be added to that list of persons and associations that can bring an action. That would be line 17, section 2, sub 1, if that list would suggest begin with the Attorney General, comma, small case A. And with that conceptual amendment, if the committee would be willing, then these would be ready to go. I want to emphasize that these amendments don't put these discount card people out of business. They are allowed to do business. If people want to buy discount cards, market discount cards, that's great. But they do need to get agreements with people before they advertise that they're offering big discounts. What's going on now would be like me sending out a letter saying, go down to U.S. Bank and get 15% on your CDs. And we all know that's not right. So with that, I conclude my testimony and respectfully urge that the committee send these to the floor if they do pass. If you have any questions, I'd be certainly glad to answer them.
Senator DeBart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, we talked about this a little bit in my office, and since then there's a number of people who have raised concerns that what's going on in this gut and stuff is a little different than what appears in the amendments, and it's been suggested that what the real motive here is to get this bill back over to the House into a conference committee where it would be further gotten stuff and replaced with the contents of 2010. Could you, on the record, could you suggest, do you have any intent to do that?
Chairman Starr and Senator Beyer, let me address that issue. There was another issue that arose with a question to me on that, too. I will certainly say on the record that there are no plans to do anything additional to this. Another concern was that the original language of 2520 could come back in a conference. We have done these amendments with the approval of Representative Montgomery, who was the original sponsor of the bill. And I certainly give my assurances that House Bill 2010 at this point is dead for the session. I have no plans to do any further work on it, and the same is true of the original House Bill 2520.
Senator Cordy, 2010.
Chairman Starr, Senator Beyer, 2010 dealt with a pharmacist's right of conscience to refuse to fill certain prescriptions. That bill failed to achieve enough votes in the House. And
by the way, Senator Cordy, prescriptions involving two issues, right?
Chairman Starr, Senator Courtney, that's correct. Two issues. The prescriptions covered in House Bill 2010 were the so-called morning after treatments, of which there are two types. One's is a post, what we refer to as a post-coital contraception. The other is what's an abortifacient called RU486, as the chemical term is known by.
Okay. Can I ask another question?
Yes.
The issue of assisted suicide has come up. What about that issue?
Chairman Starr, Senator Courtney, in what context? We have had a bill in Senate Bill 491 passed, and as far as I understand, I'm waiting the governor's signature.
That's what I thought. We had taken care of that issue there in terms of the conscience of the pharmacist and drugs and assisted suicide. Is that correct? And that's my raising, or am I confusing you?
Chairman Starr, Senator Courtney, Senate Bill 491 did address issues that we had in the context of death with dignity. We have no other legislation, amendments, or anything else on that pending.
I have a question. Are you saying that a pharmacist, like nurses, has a right of conscience to not participate in abortions, or they don't?
Chairman Starr, Senator Shannon, they do not.
And does a pharmacist then have to fulfill
a prescription that they know the patient's going to end their life with?
Chairman Starr, Senator Shannon, the process by which Definity prescriptions are handled is that the prescribing physician contacts the pharmacy, and at that point the pharmacy has the opportunity to opt out.
Oh, so they do have it in there?
Yes.
And destroying the baby. Okay.
Thank you.
That's, none of that is in this language
you
at all.
Chair, what?
It's a separate issue.
Senator Byers started down the path, and I went further because after talking to you the other day, I was inundated with, too big a word, but I was opposed that this was really a hidden agenda type of bill. That's what I asked you about. It won't be really open. This is the vehicle really going to be used for other purposes. And I was trying to get that out of the record. It's what, I realize anything can happen in this process before we send it out. I just wanted to know what I was dealing with here, and that's why we've asked these simple questions for those going to fire myself. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr, if I may, I'd further add that I've given assurances, and I would certainly be willing to put it on the record because I keep my word, that if other things done, were done to this bill, that I personally would write a letter urging that it be vetoed, even though I want this language.
Thank you.
However, you don't have control about what the health chooses to do.
Well, no, I do. Senator Starr, or Chairman Starr, Senator Shannon, of course, no, I do not, though I have assurances from the House side that nothing will be done.
Thank you very much. We have two further witnesses, Keith Shepard and Nate Sisson. Briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Shepard. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section at the Department of Justice. I'm here because your staff contacted me yesterday afternoon to provide any resource information that might be helpful to the committee in respect to the Dash A4 amendments, and I'm not here to testify about any of the other matters. Those are beyond my expertise at this point. Let me just say briefly to the committee that we have had a few complaints in our come through the Consumer Protection Unit at the Department of Justice regarding the practice that is addressed by the Dash A4 amendments. I've given the committee an example of the particular case that we did 4 or 5 years ago regarding a business by the name of Personal Benefit Services. And I know that you're pressed for time, and I'll just say that I think that the Dash A4 amendments, with the suggestion that Mr. Holt has made regarding adding the Attorney General to the list of persons who could bring an enforcement action, would be a helpful tool to address this particular practice.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Dave Siskin, representing Providence Health System. I will be very brief. I signed up when I thought it would be important for me to clarify what Mr. Holt said on the record in his testimony relative to a Providence Plus program that Providence Health System operates. Frankly, just a few moments ago, I got a call from my client saying upon further review and the amendments, we believe that they do adequately address our concerns about being exempt from this. At one point, we had a concern that that plan was operated at Providence Health System level rather than the health plans level and insurer, and we were concerned that the exemption wasn't good enough. Turns out that it is, and so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll close. Thank you very much. No further questions. We're going to close the public hearing, work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Barr.
If the Chair would allow it, I would move an amendment to the Dash 4s, simply on line 17, section 2, add at the beginning of that sentence after the paren 1, the Attorney General, comma.
And for the case, the lower case A, that secure the amendment?
Yeah.
Senator Barr has moved conceptual amendment that the Attorney General be added in line 17, at the beginning of the sentence, and or the case letter A to the small case. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I move the A4 amendments.
Senator Barr has moved the A4 amendments as amended to House Bill 2520. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2520 as amended to the floor. Would you pass?
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2520 as amended to the floor. Would you pass recommendation? Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Yes.
Senator
Tarnow.
Aye.
Senator
Byers.
Aye. Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Senator Stevens. Aye. Senator Stevens, that's a majority. House Bill 2520 moves before the two pass recommendations. Carrier? Senator Byer will carry. Thank you. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2700. And Senator Cusack.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today with the Dash 12 amendment to House Bill 2700. And these amendments include a number of recommendations for reforming the Oregon Health Plan to ensure its continued effective implementation. Since the beginning of the session, Senator Bryant and I have been working and meeting with a group of stakeholders to get their suggestions on improving the health plan. And many of the changes that are housed in this amendment were changes because of those discussions. The changes included in these amendments don't necessarily result in immediate cost savings, but over a long time, I believe that the changes will lead to more savings and, more importantly, a more sustainable Oregon health plan for low-income Oregonians. You have been just provided with a summary of the amendments, and in the interest of time, I'm going to briefly go over the major points, but Karen Smith is here to go over these carefully. If you would like to do that, that will be at the committee's direction. But I will address exactly what are the major things housed in these amendments. First of all, it requires proof of residency. The Oregon Health Plan was designed to benefit Oregonians. Section 3 of the bill ensures that the health plan resources are directed to Oregon residents by requiring applicants to show proof of residency. Too many times we've heard testimony about people who are out of state, who come to Oregon for a few months, go on to the health plan to access a specific service, and then go back to their home state. The next thing we address are co-payments. In sections 4 through 8, we require providers to collect a $2 co-payment for all office visits, non-emergency, emergency room visits, and prescription drugs. We exempt preventive care and prescription drugs necessary for health maintenance from the co-payment requirement. And probably it goes without saying, but the Oregon Health Plan was really designed to be management and preventive care, and that's why we've eliminated the preventive care aspect of this, so that we won't inhibit people from coming in for vaccinations and various checkups that are preventive medicines. But it's also a personal responsibility issue. People will take more of an interest in their care if they have some financial responsibility every time they access the system. Ancillary services. In Section 9, we require that OMAP convene with medical and dental directors and the Oregon Health Plan contractors to make recommendations concerning appropriate benefit limitations for ancillary services such as vision exams, durable medical equipment, occupational therapy, and physical therapy. Any recommendations will then go through OMAP's rulemaking process. This will ensure that ancillary services are managed appropriately and more consistently. We've also created an interim task force. Section 13 establishes a legislative interim task force to undertake a broad review of the Oregon Health Plan and make recommendations to the next legislature. This will allow the legislature the opportunity to conduct a comprehensive review of the health plan demonstration before the current waiver expires in December of 2001. The Advisory Committee on Prioritized List of Health Services also is in there. It's a task force that will receive a report from the Advisory Committee on the Prioritized List of Health Services, which will be convened as outlined in Section 10 of the amendment. The Advisory Committee will give us the opportunity to examine the effectiveness of the Prioritized List in managing Oregon health plans since its implementation. We've also added that we criminalize OHP, the Oregon Health Plan insurance fraud. In sections 14, 15, and 16, they relate to the criminalization of insurance fraud. This would apply to anyone, patients or providers, who knowingly present information to an insurer that is false or misleading. In Section 18, we limit the provision of adult dental services to those individuals who are traditional Medicaid recipients. It does not affect the provision of dental services for children in either the traditional or new eligible populations. Cutting adult dental services is not my preferred approach. But dental services are optional under Medicaid, and I feel this is a more appropriate area to look for savings rather than cutting eligibility. As you know, we all have, we do have limited resources, and so some of the choices that we make are very hard choices, but this is one of those. Sections 20 and 21 prohibit the Department of Human Resources from spending funds on services covered by the Oregon Health Plan if the federal government is prohibited from matching these funds. There are only two services that fall into this category. We would also, in Section 23, require the legislature to approve any further waiver application before the OHP demonstration may continue. The current Oregon Health Plan waiver expires on December 2001. The Oregon Health Plan was intended as a demonstration project, and I believe that the legislature should have an opportunity to examine how the demonstration has worked and whether it should be continued or amended given our now 5-plus years of experience with its implementation. I understand that some of these changes may be controversial, but they're necessary for the Oregon Health Plan to continue to serve as many low-income Oregonians as possible. And I urge the committee to adopt these amendments and would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Now, Mr. Chair, did you want Karen to go over specifically any more carefully the DACA amendments?
I think not at this time. We may need some assistance after we had further testimony. We've got several folks signed up to testify. And let me see. We've got, I think that we will excuse you.
Okay, we'll stand up.
And I appreciate that very much. We have Representative Bob Jensen like to testify, and then we're going to go down the list.
Thank you very much, Chairman Starr, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would like to say that testimony, and I have two amendments that I believe you have, a DAC 8 and a DAC 11 amendments, and those are brought to me rather late in the session here by constituents or concern for constituents, and it is those issues that as you proceed through this and perhaps as any study or investigation of the Oregon Health Plan takes place in the interim, that would be that they would be considered. I'd like to say that I do laud the Oregon Health Plan and its success in providing health insurance to thousands of people that otherwise would not have it. However, I believe that as we have gone through it and as we have observed, that there are some areas that it needs to be tweaked or to minor changes need to be made in it, both in terms of the economics and also perhaps in terms of the services that are delivered. The Dash 8 and Dash 11 amendments that I'm proposing to you, would in essence do that. The Dash 8 amendment would allow that insured under the Oregon Health Plan to be able to choose a physician of their choice through their provider. Well, I believe that this was something of the original intent of the Oregon Health Plan. It is not specified in statute, and it's certainly not being done today. As a result, some providers have limited the choice of certain insured participants. Simple amendment that we have in the Dash 8 that would be an attempt to fix this. And I do refer to my particular community as far as primary care physicians in my particular community. There are only about 5 primary care physicians. And of those 5, not all of them take the Oregon Health Plan, take patients from the Oregon Health Plan. A couple take patients from the Oregon Health Plan, but will not take any new patients from the Oregon Health Plan. The concern came to me because people were wanting to go outside of the community from Pendleton, in other words, to Hermiston, get to a primary care provider, and were unable to do that. And that was the reason for this particular issue, that service was basically unavailable in the community, was available in another community. The Dash 11 amendments would allow those insured under the Oregon Health Plan who need assistance sorting out the questions with their medical billing or other general assistance be able to go to an office in their community and talk to someone. At the present time, they have an 800 number that they can call as staffed by people here in Salem. And with all due respect to the folks here in Salem who are staffing those, we would appreciate that the number of staff they have and the amount of time that they have to spend makes it very difficult for them to serve the entire state. Recognizing that many of the people who need the Oregon Health Plan may have difficulty sometimes cutting through the chase on this, as perhaps all of us do as we deal with trying to deal with playing the numbers game on a telephone, waiting for the appropriate option, and then when you finally get through the entire menu, realizing there was no appropriate option, only to start all over again. The Dash 11 amendments, in short, then create an Oregon Health Plan Ombudsman to be located in the Adult Family Services Division, or for that matter, anywhere. That seemed the most logical place. Across the state in the 52 offices that they have, where the ombudsman will have experience with healthcare issues, community programs, healthcare providers, low-income populations, and thus the people will be able to go someplace and actually talk to a person to deal with their problems. Fully aware, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that there is fiscal impact in attempting to do this, and I understand the dilemma that very well that we have in this building as we deal with these issues on fiscal impact. And I'm only asking your consideration of ways that these issues might be addressed if these are not the appropriate ways. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions to the witness? Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Elizabeth Fire. Have Phil Cox come on up, Jane Meyer. Right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Fires. I work for the Oregon Health Action Campaign. I represent them here. Within the Oregon Health Action Campaign, I'm also representing a campaign for patients' rights and Project Equality. Project Equality being a consumer group of people who are on the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid, and now parents of children who are on the CHIP program. We want to talk now about House Bill 2700, and I have Dash 12, but I understand there are further amendments that I don't have here. And I want to talk about our opposition to most of those amendments. When we talk about requiring people to prove residency and ask them to have a driver's license, which costs money, an ID card, which costs money, a tax return, which means that people have an income when a substantial number of people who apply for Oregon Health Plan have none, it doesn't seem to make sense to fill this bill with amendments that are going to make it more difficult for poor people to obtain services. In general, it's so difficult for poor people to get services on the Oregon Health Plan that I question whether it's a big problem of people coming here, circumventing all the gatekeepers that are in place and receiving services. I don't see evidence of that being a huge issue. The next amendment is talking about adopting co-payments for Oregon Health Plan services. That's a bill that we've already spoken about, that's already not been passed through. Again, we've made all the arguments against co-payments, how it restricts access for people who don't have available disposable income, and especially for people who have multiple conditions that require multiple visits to the doctor in a month, multiple prescriptions. Those people are hurt and would avoid getting the care they needed, would end up in the emergency rooms, thus being much more expensive clients. We want to talk about plans to convene OMAP, medical and dental directors and Oregon Health Plan contractors groups to make recommendations relating to the establishment of appropriate benefit limitations for ancillary services. Again, they're hard enough to get already. There are already limitations, and I would suggest in future looking at groups like that, that you'd want to include some consumers on there. You're going to get a whole lot better support from the community for a program like this if you include consumers of the program in a group that's going to set limits for the program. And the next thing we want to talk about is another advisory committee on the prioritized list of health services. A good idea to get back to the original process that created the Oregon Health Plan. Again, please let consumers be part of that process. They're going to have real and good suggestions about moving the plan forward and making it really reflect what this state needs. We're going to require prior authorization for non-emergent ambulance services. I think that's a fine idea. I believe that there already are some prior authorization rules. What we'd like to see, rather than more rules about prior authorization, is a 24-hour line to give that prior authorization or make suggestions as to how to avoid using the more costly ambulance services. So what we need is a 24-hour prior authorization line, not more rules about prior authorization. I'm fine with vigorously pursuing third-party payment. But if we're looking at a legislative interim task force on the Oregon Health Plan, again, please let consumers have access to that process. There just isn't anybody else who can talk to the issues that we're dealing with here today better than consumers. Criminalize OHP insurance fraud. I believe that the Justice Department already pursues a process that does that. Prohibit payment of out-of-state claims made by Oregon Health Plan enrollees. There's still some issues about how the Medicaid laws would interact with that. Limit provision of adult dental services to traditional Medicaid recipients. Very problematical, because what we're trying to do with the Oregon Health Plan is help people move into employability And I can tell you, if you don't have teeth, you're not going to work. It's pretty simple. Or adults who want to work need access to dental services. All to the prioritized list. If interim cuts are necessary, I think that's something we need to talk more about. Prohibits the Department of Human Resources from spending state funds on services for which federal funds may not be extended. That's an issue that my group doesn't get involved with. The other issues are pretty clear. I just want to definitely highlight the second from bottom in my summary, which says subject advisory committees related to programs and medical assistance made up of two or more members are open to the public, subject to open meeting laws. It's very exciting to see the one thing that we are really, really in favor of is having open meetings when they concern the programs that we're involved with. None of these decisions or discussions should be happening in private where consumers can't be appraised of what the process is and how to affect change in the process. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Philip Cox. I'm the Health Services Administrator for the Oregon Youth Authority. First, I'd like to apologize for coming so late in this process. We unfortunately are following juvenile justice bills, and this has sort of come up pretty late for us. I'm here representing the Deputy Director and the Director of the Youth Authority. Neither in support nor in opposition to this particular bill, but rather to inform the committee of a few provisions of the bill that will have direct fiscal impact on the Youth Authority. Section 4 and the -10 amendments require a $2 copayment for all persons receiving medical assistance under the Oregon Health Plan. Youth who are committed to the Oregon Youth Authority and placed in foster care or in residential treatment or in group homes are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan or enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. Our fiscal analysis indicates that given that we are responsible for the co-payments for these youth, there will be a direct impact of around $133,000 per year for averaging approximately 4 visits per month per youth in foster care. An additional section of the bill that we've identified as having fiscal impact on the agency would be section number 3, which indicates that recipients of benefits under the health plan need be Oregon residents. We have a small number of youth offenders who are placed in foster care outside of the state. Those youth are eligible for Medicaid through Oregon. They receive medical cards from Oregon, and providers may provide services currently and submit claims to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Essentially, those are the two provisions that we feel that the committee would like to probably know when it's considering the -10 amendments to this bill, and I'm certainly available to answer any questions committee members may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association. And we strongly oppose the elimination of the dental services, both for the new eligible adults and for, in some cases, if funding is short, for the categorically needy adults. I've given you, there are 5 reasons for that. I think most of you are aware of the need for dental care in our state. Oral health care is an important part of physical health care, and as Ms. Beyer said, a lot of time is lost from school and employment. In fact, some people can't get employed if they have obvious dental problems. So we think that elimination of adults is a step backwards in achieving better health for Oregonians. It also defeats one of the key purposes of the Oregon Health Plan, which is to do prevention, because most dental disease is completely preventable if we, you know, get a start on it. But without the treatment for adults who already have it, we're losing more ground. I want to point out to you, we gave you a study that was done in Maryland. This is just the tip of the iceberg. If there are no services for the needy adults in the Oregon Health Plan, we do expect a significant increase in patients looking for treatment in hospital emergency rooms, which is very ineffective and unsatisfactory to everyone involved, the patients and the hospitals and their staff. Typically, the person ends up with painkillers and maybe a drain if they have an abscess, but their dental disease is still untreated at that level. So while sending or the hospital's resources being billed back to other patients and insurers, that's a really ineffective way to handle the need for dental care, and I particularly want to emphasize that. We're also hearing from the dental care organizations that they may not be able to continue operation with significant reductions in funding, that they need the total dollars to handle all of the costs of their operation. And typically, the capitation rate for children is a small amount of money that may not cover the cost of operating a dental clinic. If you can imagine the equipment, the staff, time, and the supplies that are involved in dental treatment, you know it's not an inexpensive treatment program. And we think the public made it clear when the program was designed a number of years back that they thought dental services were an important part of what is a non-traditional Medicaid program, includes more people, and it prioritizes the list of services. So that's our major concern. We also don't support the copay for the Oregon Health Plan enrollees. And even though the amendments in Dash 12 look like some of the reimbursement would not be reduced to the practitioners, it still causes a problem in trying to collect copays in dental offices from needy people, and we think it also imposes a barrier for them to come in for regular routine treatments. Also, I guess I'd say on the advisory committee and the interim task force, this is a problem that the Oregon Dental Association has been fighting for a number of years, that there needs to be representation of the dentists on these groups. The healthcare community is not well aware of the kind of specialized treatment and needs of operating dental clinics. It would be very helpful to have a dentist participate in those groups which are helping foreign policy recommendations to the legislature. About the insurance fraud provisions, we have some problem that health service provider in there is not clearly defined and are wondering if it includes the managed care plans or only individual practitioners. And then we just have some problems which come up about the severity of the penalties involved. Although they may be warranted, the a Class C felony is a maximum sentence is 5 years and a $100,000 fine, and a B felony is 10 years and a $200,000 fine. And where our concern comes from is that we typically get complaints from practitioners who have been audited that some of the auditing system is unfair. And the auditing system is where you may get into a finding or making an accusation that an office has committed fraud. Some of the audit, and I guess this is just going to be a complaint about the auditing process, they'll use a random sample of the claims, and yet when the dentist has to defend that there was no fraud intended or there were no errors there, the dentist has to use a case-by-case proof to demonstrate that the state audit is not correct. And in one case, I want to point out that it tends to present a barrier sometimes if audits and those kind of sanctions become really strong in offices, because we had a practitioner, a pediatric dentist, who are in very short supply. But because he does a lot of Medicaid patients, the number of claims got him on the radar screen of Medicaid, and he went through an audit process. I don't know that they found anything wrong with his account, but auditing does take time and staff time. So we have some concerns that if you've already got provisions in the law to handle Medicaid fraud, or if you need to beef these up, that they be done so that they don't discourage the practitioners who are trying to treat Medicaid patients from treating them. And with that, I'll answer any questions I can.
Any questions? Thank you very much. This is Senator Bryant. Okay. Hirsch Crawford. Sylvia Terry. And Ruth Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Hirsch Crawford, the Director of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. There have been a lot said, I think, up to this point about the Dash 12 amendments, and what I had intended to do was to sort of briefly go through the amendments, and I'm not going to read my testimony, but go through the amendments, describe the changes, and indicate to you areas where we may have some concerns with some of the changes that are proposed. The testimony that you have before you was prepared based upon the Dash 10 amendments. I didn't know the 12s were available until I got to the hearing today, but I've looked through them, and I think I've identified the spots where they're different, and I'll try and point that out as I go through the testimony. In terms of Section 3 in both the Dash 10 and the Dash 12 amendments, it does require proof of residency. We believe that that can be done. We don't have a final decision from HCFA on that yet, but we think it can be done. It's likely, though, that HCFA would require some sort of an exception process for people who are homeless or mentally ill or who may otherwise have some sort of a problem with complying with the process that's set forth in the statute. I'd also like to point out, though, that as Section 3 is written, that would apply to all Medicaid recipients in Oregon, including the elderly and the disabled, and would mean that there would be additional proof of residency required for those populations, as well as people who are newly covered under the Oregon Health Plan. We've talked a lot about copays, and that is in Sections 4, 5, and 6, and 7 in both the Dash 10 and Dash 12 amendments. They apply to office visits, a flat copay of $2. And while the bill does require that we apply for Medicaid waivers to implement provisions of the Dash 12 amendment statement that may conflict with federal requirements, I just wanted to point out that it does, at this point, conflict with federal requirements in a number of different ways. Currently, federal Medicaid rules would prohibit copayments for children. They also would prohibit copayments for pregnant women, people who are in institutions, for emergency services, and for family planning services. The $2 amount that's proposed, I think, is within the range of what would be acceptable under the federal copayment requirements. Mr. Cox had talked about the impact on copayments on children who are in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I think that situation also applies to children who are in foster care in services to children and families, in that those agencies would be required to pay the copay if we continue to make these copayments apply to children. In addition, as written, the copayments would also apply to elderly and disabled who are covered under Medicaid in Oregon. And because elderly and disabled individuals who have excess income use a portion of that income to help offset the cost of their care, if some of their excess income is used to pay copayments, then there is less income available to offset the cost of their care, and the cost to the Senior and Disabled Services Division goes up. I also just would like to comment a little bit on the requirement that copayments be applied to drugs. While certainly that is standard practice for the general population, I think it's likely that even a small copayment for a population in poverty may make it much more difficult for that purpose to get that person to get their prescription filled. The result of that is that you probably would see a decrease in drug costs, but you may see an increase in other health care costs, more than offsetting the savings on drugs. Section 9 of the -12 amendments mandates a process to review benefit limitations for ancillary services. The process that's proposed in the amendments is very similar to the one that we went through in 1995 when the elderly and disabled individuals were moved into the Oregon Health Plan. Our concern with Section 9 is that it also stipulates that benefits for ancillary services could not be more generous in the health plan than you find in a typical commercial insurance plan in Oregon. Our concern is that commercial benefit limitations are developed for a very different population, and they may in fact not be appropriate for elderly, vulnerable, or disabled people. The other thing which complicates this a little bit is it would be difficult to figure out which commercial insurance benefit package was the standard by which we would have to compare our benefits to. And ancillary services, as far as Section 9 is concerned, refer to routine vision exams, eyeglasses, medical supplies, durable medical equipment, speech and language therapy, hearing aids, other types of aids, physical therapy, occupational therapy. Section 10 of the -12 amendments sets up an advisory committee to review the process by which the prioritized list is developed. I just would like to comment that the current methodology that the Health Services Commission uses was the result of a fairly protracted series of negotiations between the state and the Healthcare Financing Administration and the Department of Justice, and was finally sort of agreed to by the Department of Justice as a process that met the Americans with Disabilities Act. We believe that if that methodology were to be changed, that certainly HCRA and the Department of Justice would be interested in that, and any change could be subject to disapproval at that level. Section 13 sets up an interim legislative task force to review a number of options with respect to the Oregon Health Plan and make recommendations to the legislature. I just wanted to comment that two of the things that are proposed to be on the task force agenda, looking at positive and negative outcomes of instituting competitive bidding and examining provider payment methods, it's likely that both of those would require or could require a substantial amount of time by an actuary, and that can be very expensive. We don't see that cost addressed anywhere in the amendments. Section 17 basically says that medical services that are delivered outside the state of Oregon would not be covered under the Oregon Health Plan unless those services meet two exception criteria. One, that they are delivered within what's referred to as the contiguous area, which is basically a 75-mile-wide band around the state of Oregon that we treat as though it were in-state, because many people who are close to the border go into Idaho or California or Washington to get their health care. So if services were delivered within that contiguous area, they could be paid for, or if the Office of Medical Assistance Programs or one of our health care contractors had prior authorized that service, that could be paid for. The issue we have is that it precludes payment for emergency services when someone is out of state, and that would be a violation of federal Medicaid requirements. In addition, services to children and families, as well as the Oregon Youth Authority, occasionally place children out of state, and providing medical care for out-of-state placements is currently paid for by the Oregon Health Plan, and that could be more difficult if all of those services had to be prior authorized. Section 18 eliminates dental services for non-traditional Medicaid eligibles or non-traditional health plan eligibles. There's about 80,000 adults in this group. There are people who wouldn't be eligible for health care in Oregon were it not for the expansion of eligibility that has occurred under the health plan. As Senator Kutup pointed out, dental services under Medicaid are an optional service, And while we believe it's likely that HCFA would probably approve this change because the change is limited to adults. In my written testimony, I had indicated that there might be a problem with children, but that has been fixed in the Dash 12 amendments. It's clear in the Dash 12 amendments that the elimination of dental coverage would just apply to adults who are in the expansion population. Section 19 of the Dash 12 amendments indicates or sets up a process whereby during the interim, if a plan to rebalance the Oregon health plan budget were disapproved by the emergency board, then the Health Services Commission would be required to alter the prior authorized list, and as a result of that, they would exclude dental services for all traditional Medicaid eligibles who are adults. Again, the Dash 10 amendments made reference both to adults and children, but the Dash 12 clears that up and applies this change only to adults. Section 20 of the Dash 12 amendments would eliminate funding in the Oregon Health Plan for both abortions and death with dignity services. And that's Section 21 is also a part of that. And Section 23 in the Dash 12 amendments would apply components of Oregon's open meeting law, would move those over into the Oregon Health Plan statutes for advisory committees. We're not entirely clear why this was proposed. We believe it may be related to the work of a formulary subcommittee, which was appointed by the medical directors of the Oregon Health Plan managed care plans. Our concern with this is that it simply is a change to the statute that addresses a very narrow situation and for just a single particular interest, special interest group. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions?
I want to know, he's talking about that they're not funding a special interest group, or what was this? I just came in the tail.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, I was talking about Section 23 in the Dash 12 amendments, and what it does is move some of the open meeting requirements into the Oregon Health Plan statutes. And what it would, we're not exactly sure why that has been done. We believe it has to do with the work of a group of medical directors for Oregon Health Plan contractors that have been meeting together to talk about coordination of formularies for drugs across many health care plans. They have felt that they could do that better if those were closed meetings, and that's the way they've been operating. And we believe that Section 23 is designed to prevent that and require that open meetings, the statutes apply to those types of meetings. And we're just simply concerned because we're taking the open meeting statutes and addressing those at a very narrow situation and just, that addresses just one particular interest group.
Other questions?
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, if it's going to affect everybody and everybody's going to pay for it, I'm just, if it's public funds we're talking about, I just wonder why you would oppose that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, if I'm right in why the amendment is here, it is our belief that the medical directors of our managed health care plans have been meeting for some time to talk about coordinating formularies because they felt it was better to the extent that plans could have standardized formularies across the plans, it would make operation of the health plan more consistent across different managed health care plans. They felt that it would be difficult to have those discussions with representatives of drug manufacturers sitting in the room. And in order to have those discussions with representatives of drug manufacturers, they closed those meetings. And it's our understanding that it is the intent of this section to force those meetings to be open.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sylvia Keeley, and I'm with the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center is a nonprofit law firm that represents low-income people in civil legal matters, and the vast majority of our clients are members of the Oregon Health Plan, and many of those clients also are homeless or have been homeless at times experience mental health diagnoses, and they will be very affected by a lot of the amendments contained in Dash 12. My written comments address the Dash 10 amendments, and I have reviewed the Dash 12. I am only going to address a few of the issues raised in my testimony. To begin with, the residency issue. I believe Mr. Crawford addressed a lot of my concerns with regard to the residency issue. We're very concerned for homeless people who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan who will not possess the paper documentation necessary to prove that they are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Homeless individuals have a hard time keeping up with their documents. People with mental health diagnoses, particularly if they're also homeless, have added burdens, and we are concerned that they will be denied rightful access to the Oregon Health Plan. With regard to the copayment issue, I have many concerns with regard to the copayment. It definitely will create a barrier to care. I think a lot of people who don't have the $2 flat copayment will not seek care, even though federal regulations require that care cannot be denied. They won't go because they don't have the money. They're afraid they'll be denied. It's a pride issue, whatever. In addition, for people who receive the care even though they are unable to pay the $2 copay, they remain financially liable. And for individuals who are going to need a lot of care, $2 will add up and add up and add up. And I'd hate to see them in collections for money that they don't have. We're dealing with extremely low-income people here. And I think a lot of our clients would forego health care for themselves in order to feed their kids. With regard to the exemption on prescriptions for the copay, the exemption applies to medications that are regular and frequent. Well, what about the person with walking pneumonia that needs an antibiotic to care for that? That's probably not a regular and frequent prescription like insulin might be or something like that to control ongoing diabetes. The issue comes up if what happens to them if they don't have the $2. We are concerned that in the doctor's office it may be easier to get the care even if the copay cannot be paid. That may be a little bit more difficult when you're dealing with a checkout clerk at a pharmacy in paying the $2 copay. There's an exemption for a copay that is for hospital services that result in an admission to a hospital. Well, there are many admissions to people who are admitted to the emergency room for legitimate emergency situations that may not result in an admission to the hospital. For instance, someone who's under the Oregon Health Plan falls and breaks their wrist. It's a weekend. They go into the emergency room. It can be closed without surgery and a cast put on. I think most everyone would say that that's an emergency, but it probably isn't going to result in an admission to the hospital. They're going to have to pay a copay. And we believe that federal regulations would preclude that. We also have concern for the non-traditional Medicaid eligibles who are already paying premiums for their Oregon Health Plan coverage. A $2 copay would be an additional burden on them. The Dash 12 amendments do not contain any provision for an upper limit on accumulation of copayments and for people who have chronic illnesses or disabilities or something like that who require a lot of treatment and care. $2 is going to add up quickly. At what point do we not continue to charge them? We are concerned that the copay will add added stress to the still unfunded safety net clinics. People who don't have a copay and feel that they will not get care are going to end up in safety net clinics. Our next area of concern is Section 9, the benefits limitations. That list of needs that needs to be addressed, we are very concerned, perhaps not intentionally, but looking at the language is directed or would definitely affect disabled individuals, and we have concerns that that might violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. With regard to the prioritized list of services, I believe this list is something that Oregon takes deep pride in, and it was worked out over a long period of time with community input, and I am very concerned about another entity, an advisory committee, deciding that there should be changes in that list without going through the same kind of process that was undergone in 1991 when the list was developed in the first place. In Section 11, the non-emergency ambulance services, it is our understanding that a Medicaid agency needs to ensure necessary transportation for recipients to and from providers. And we understand and don't want people inappropriately using ambulance service, but we do have transportation problems, particularly in rural Oregon, with people not being able to get to providers, and we're concerned that this prior authorization issue will be particularly problematic on weekends and holidays, and both the providers and OMAP are going to have to come up with some kind of a system for dealing with this issue, which I'm sure is going to have a financial and administrative burdens on both. With regard to the dental issue, I'm glad to see that the Dash 12s eliminate denial of dental for children. But dental is terribly important to low-income people, particularly those moving from welfare to work, who are mainly employed in service industry kinds of jobs, people who don't have teeth or have visible dental caries and this type of thing, have a hard time getting jobs. We're also concerned with the elimination of dental. What happens to those emergencies, very painful abscess teeth, for instance? All of those people are going to end up in the emergency room, which increases the cost shift and costs. And I believe Ms. Myers with the Oregon Dental Association agrees that that would happen. And I've heard a figure of 20% increase in emergency room visits for those dental kinds of situations. And those are basically my, in the interest of time, major issues with these amendments. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm an attorney with Triangle and Gary Rudnick. I'm here representing Kaiser Permanente. I've furnished the committee with a rather extensive letter of comments about the Dash 10, and like the others, I've seen the Dash 12 amendments today. I think the issues that I've addressed in the letter are applicable to the Dash 12 amendments as well. And so I would simply encourage the committee to review those comments. We have specific concerns both about the design of the co-payment system and of the requirement to not pay for out-of-state emergency care services. In addition to those comments, I have elaborated about a dozen specific technical drafting issues that you may want to consider in the amendment session. I will not review that written testimony for you, but I do want to take the opportunity to comment on some of the additional amendments that have been offered to the committee this afternoon. Representative Jensen has offered Dash 8 amendments, and we would express significant reservations about that approach. The Oregon Health Plan is premised on a managed care approach to managing the care for Medicaid recipients. I read the Dash 8 amendments as resulting in the elimination of managed care under the Oregon Health Plan because they would allow an enrollee to go to any willing provider. And so there would no longer be the intermediary managed care organizations like Kaiser Permanente that are responsible for organizing and delivering care to Medicaid enrollees. I think those amendments refer to a old system, old Medicaid system of fee-for-service, freedom of choice, a system that basically was unmanageable, the budgets were uncontrollable, and that drove us to ultimately adopt the Oregon Health Plan as a more rational system of managing the resources. For that reason, we would strongly urge the committee to not adopt the Dash 8 amendments as they are drafted. With regard to the Dash 11 amendments, which Representative Jensen offered, those propose the creation of a number of new positions in state government, ombudsman positions that would be stationed in every Adult and Family Services Division office throughout the state. Regardless of the merits of that, it seems to me it will be an expensive undertaking. And we also believe that those services would duplicate services that we as a managed care organization are expected by the state already to provide to the enrollees in the Medicaid program. So we think it would create a new layer of bureaucracy within state government, probably 60 or 70 new positions there just to be providing a service that the state's already holding us accountable to provide for our enrollees. That's part of the contract that we have to provide those kinds of services. And we think that the privatization of those requirements through contracts like those with Kaiser Permanente is a better approach than for the establishment of those new positions in state government. For that reason, we would also oppose the Dash 11 amendments. There are Dash 13 amendments, which no one has addressed yet, to my recollection at least, that have to do with the health resources. If they are presented, we don't read them yet as being objectionable unless there's something that I'm not able to pick up on them. And finally, there was a set of Dash 15 amendments that also has not been presented to the committee yet. Those would require 60-day notice, I believe, for a change in contractual terms. And if those are offered to the committee, then we would support that as a way of stabilizing funding under the program so that we avoid unilateral changes in contract mid-contract year without an opportunity to have further discussions with the agency about those changes. With those specific comments on those additional amendments, I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, might I comment very briefly on the Dash 8 amendments?
Yes.
The language that's in the Dash 8 amendments was not clear to us either. And if in fact, it allows somebody to pick a primary care physician who is outside the managed health care plan, then we would very definitely agree with Mr. Bishop and oppose that. If, on the other hand, what Representative Jensen is trying to do with the Dash 8 amendments is simply to require that someone have the opportunity to choose a primary care physician who is participating in the plan in which they're enrolled, we would have no objection to that. It's just not clear to us what the Dash 8 amendment is trying to do with it.
Heatherington. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Heatherington. I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated, one of the Oregon Health Plan contractors. Would like to speak to several of the amendments being offered. First of all, in terms of the Dash 12 that were offered, we would offer our support in those with, I have one or two comments to make, but generally we're in support of the entire process. I would make a comment in this that the Dash 12s are, in my view, a combination of a whole bunch of concerns that were brought forward and listened to very attentively by Senator Bryant and Senator Qutub over a four-month period of time. It's probably one of the best discussions we've had on health care in the legislative process in my experience in 22 years. So I wouldn't discount what's been done in 2700. I think it's been a very thoughtful process and something that I would urge the committee to look favorably upon.
With regard to the amendment, the area on co-pays, we strongly support the co-pays amendments. philosophically, I think the providers that we have talked to out in the field feel that there's an important aspect of a co-pay that says people can help be responsible for their own health care. The providers understand, and we understand, that there are a lot of people who will be exempt and a lot of people who can't pay. Under the federal rules, they will not have to pay. But the philosophical point about the fact is that you will be asked to pay if you can, we think is very important. There is one omission in terms of exclusions from the co-pays, which we would offer and was talked about in our work group, and that is that referred services when a primary care physician refers a patient on to a radiologist or a surgeon for consultative work, we do not feel that that should be subject to a copay. That is not, you know, part of the patient's choice. At that point, they're being sent for further medical care. That would address the issue about inpatient hospital and not outpatient hospital. We think referred services should be excluded. The issue was raised by the department about foster care and agencies having to pay the $2 copay. Let me tell you, there's not a physician's office in the world that's going to spend $7 to bill an agency for two. So I don't think that's a real issue. Lastly, on page 2, which is subsection 3 on line 26, and I would say I'm really talking on behalf of the providers that we have under contract, we'd like to see that deleted. You're asking physicians' offices, dental offices, hospitals to count up the number of $2 copayments that they receive and report that to the division every 2 years. And that, I mean, every 6 months. That's a huge administrative burden for a very little amount of money, and we would certainly urge that be taken care of. The one area where I would have a disagreement with the Dash 27s is in the dental area. I understand the need to balance the budget and all that, but there is a price to pay on dental, which is different than what's been represented, or I would say in addition to what's been represented. And that is that costs don't disappear when you have dental problems. They generally shift. And so if they're not going to be handled by a dentist,
or not. Jeff, you said Dash 27. Are we at the 27 yet?
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant the Dash 12.
Okay. Thank you.
If anybody else heard that, I probably scared the daylights out of them.
Yeah. Thank you.
In terms of the dental, what will happen on adults is they'll end up seeking medical care instead of dental care. And so costs will go up for emergency room use and for the pharmaceutical. And I just want to make that point. We think it's very unfortunate if the dental ends up being excluded for the adults for the reasons cited by other people who make testimony and for the fact that I don't think all of the costs will disappear that you thought. With regard to the Dash 8 amendments that were offered, we happen to be the provider in Pendleton. And I did talk to the representative about the issue. There is other ways to handle that. There are two health plan contractors in the Umatilla County area. And the example he cited was if they happen to be in Hermiston and they're on the health plan in Pendleton, they can't go. Well, the easy administrative way for them to see the doctor of their choice is simply to change health plan. And that option is available to them. We regularly help people change to another health plan if their doctor happens to be on someone else's panel and not on ours, and I know all the other health plans do too, because it doesn't serve anybody's purpose to have someone on a health plan where they can't see the provider they want. So we believe that the amendment is unnecessary. With regard to the Dash 15s, which we are offering, along with Senator Bryant, who was going to be here and evidently is fighting a quorum in judiciary. The Dash 15s were brought about because of some administrative changes and some contractual changes that happened with the fully capitated health plan. What we found happened in the October 1999 or 98 contracting was that it appeared in our contract that contractors had absolutely no appeal rights under the Oregon Health Plan. As part of the discussion we had in both the interim work group and in this legislative sessions work group, what's offered here is a methodology whereby contractors who have issues with the rate setting process or covered services process and feel like that the rates and the covered services do not match what is true in the real world in terms of payments, that they can jointly, that they can appeal those decisions before they have to sign a contract. Now the situation is you either sign the contract or you don't have any contract at all. So if you're either in or you're out. What happened in the Dash 15s is there was an omission. There's been a little bit of several iterations of this, but on line 2, or excuse me, line 7 in subsection 2, it says if two or more health care providers object to the proposed change of reimbursement, those providers may jointly appeal to the change to the Director of Human Resources. Reasonably put in 2 was so you just didn't have one. You had to have, you know, some critical mass for an appeal to go forward. What was left out, and you will find in the Dash 14 amendments, was that if the appeal to the Director of Human Resources is not to the satisfaction of two or more providers, is they can go to a contested case hearing. And the addition of those two areas, both the appeal to the director and the appeal to the for a contested case hearing, are part of what we originally offered. They didn't come out of LC that way, and Senator Bryant and I have talked about that. He is in favor of having both appeal routes in the legislation. So what we would offer is to go back to LC and ask them to put the contested case language back in. There is a fail-safe provision down there in Section 4, which basically says we don't have appeal rights if the federal government says we have to do it that way. And, of course, that's pretty standard.
Thank you.
Be happy to answer.
Senator Bryan.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm the senator from District 27, Central Oregon. And as chair of the Interim Budget Committee, I selected human resources area as my area of concentration. And in particular, I intended to study the Oregon Health Plan and OMAP and try to figure it out and offer direction as to where we should go in the future. I want to say in the beginning I wasn't entirely successful in that effort. It is difficult and it is confusing and it is complex. And there was a work group formed that talked about general items, and that work group continued to expand. And then when Senator Qtub was appointed the co-chair of the subcommittee on ways and means dealing with this, she took over that same work group, and we continued to meet. And in House Bill 2700, you have many good ideas that I think will help the implementation of the plan, also save a little money, correct some deficiencies, improve the perception of the plan as it relates to residency, fraud, those sorts of things. And also what's happened by this work group meeting is communication level between OMAP and the contractors has improved a great deal. It helps having them sit at a table and ask pointed and difficult questions, and we had long discussions. The amendments that were just discussed, I think, make sense. Gary Weiss from the Human Resource Department would like to first have a shot, an opportunity to review what the issue is that's in dispute between OMAP and a contractor. I think that's fair. But at the same time, I do think if there's still a disagreement, the contractor should be allowed to have a contested case process and if necessary, go through that. So, and there is a fail-safe, as was mentioned by Jeff, dealing with the federal government says you have to do it this way in order to get funding. That's the way you do it. The one area that I am in disagreement with in the amendments deals with Section 20, and it says, notwithstanding subsection 1A of this section, the department may not expend any sums to provide medical assistance or services
that if provided would not receive whole or partial funding from the federal government. As a practical matter, what this would do would eliminate funding for two programs. One is physician-assisted suicide, and the other deals with abortion. On physician-assisted suicide, I don't think the Oregon Health Plan should cover that. And it's a minor expense at this time now because we've had very few who've gone that direction, I think 15 or 16. On the abortion issue, that is, of course, much more controversial. And my fear is by putting it in this bill rather than a standalone bill, it would be vetoed. And in doing that, we'd lose some of the other provisions here that aren't controversial. So that's my concern in including section. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I just want to say people of goodwill can disagree. I don't agree with gun bills either.
We have some more witnesses. Dave Siscom, Amy Malone, Jim Gardner.
Chair, good afternoon, the committee members. My name is Dave Siscom. I'm here representing Providence Health System. As you may know by now, we are a large system in this state with a number of hospitals, but for the purposes of Health Bill 2700, it's important to note that Providence Health Plans is a contract under the Oregon Health Plan and has been instrumental from the start in the creation of and the support of the Oregon Health Plan. Today we serve in the neighborhood of 40,000 clients in this state. Further, we have a substantial commitment to the Oregon Health Plan and have demonstrated that commitment over the years. I want to say as I begin what will be a brief summary of some comments, express my appreciation to Senator Q-Tub as well as Senator Bryant, who both convened work groups during the interim as well as this session, and we had a lot of opportunity for input and comment on the provisions contained in this bill and others, and for that, I want to express the appreciation of the Providence Health System. We do want to mention only a few comments today, and I, before doing that, want to say that I would endorse a number of the suggestions made to you in the letter from Bruce Bishop on behalf of Kaiser. I was tempted to read you the entire letter today, but instead I won't and will simply indicate that I think that is worth a review of your staff in terms of perfecting some of the language, at least, if not some of the issues in Health Bill 2700, and so I won't refer to it. A brief comment on copays, and I know that's an element of some interest in these amendments. Frankly, Providence Health System has mixed emotions on this, and I've sat around tables where we've talked about it for a long time. We understand the issue well spoken by Senator Cuta today about instilling an ethic of personal responsibility, and copays are part of doing that. At the same time, it's administratively very, very difficult. We particularly would share comments made by others about the reporting requirements relative to copays, which we think are onerous. And Amy Malone, to my right, Providence's Oregon Health Plan Coordinator, will mention that in a couple of comments she wants to make about the Dash 12, 15, and 8 amendments to 2700. And so, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll turn to Amy to my right with your permission.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Amy Malone. I'm with Providence Health Plan. I would also like to thank Senators Bryant and Q-Tub for the opportunity to work on the work groups with them, and appreciate the work of both their staff on coming up with these Dash 12 and other amendments to 2700. Providence does support, you know, a residency ID requirement. However, there is a provision in the current language that says it requires 3 pieces of ID, and I would just request that you reconsider 3 pieces of ID, especially for homeless and some other populations. It seems like that might be a little excessive, so I'd request that that be reconsidered. Adult dental is a concern to Providence because it could increase medical costs or ER costs, There could be a decrease in children's use. If the parents aren't coming in, they might not bring their children in. And it is also a threat in general to the dental provider infrastructure, especially in rural areas, if you don't have the broad base of membership coming in, and that concerns us. In the Dash 12 amendments, the copay, while we support the idea, again, the administrative difficulty is a concern, and we would advocate more for a thoughtful process to consider a copay program that would be more easily administered and also that might have a stronger chance of being passed by HCSA. So we would just like to approach a slower approach to this, but do agree with the concept. On the Dash 8 amendments, we are also concerned that it will allow members to go out of our network, and we would not endorse that. If it does just allow members' choice within the plan, there are administrative rules that address that, and we would have no problem. And also, we do allow members to choose a PCP within plan. But if it allows them to go out of network, that is a concern to the managed care concept. On the Dash 15 amendments, Providence Health Plan considers the Dash 15 amendments unnecessary. First of all, it is too broad in that it speaks to all providers, not just managed care contractors. And I think it started out in the work group that it was the managed care plans who felt that their contracts were being amended too often. And this language speaks just to any provider providing medical services to the eligible population. And that concerns us that it would be any fee-for-service provider, not just managed care contractors. Additionally, there is a contract and rules work group that meets monthly and as necessary. It's made up of all the contractors are invited, enough contractors and OMAP to discuss proposed changes. We have met very recently and many times on the contracts for the 99 contracts. We even held a special meeting in Salem trying to get and reminded all the contractors, please come, please give input. And we discussed this provision of notification timelines and came to compromise with OMAP. Therefore, I believe that the Dash 15 amendment is unnecessary and might interfere with that collaborative process that takes place. I do have to answer any questions that the committee has.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I want to begin again by, as did my colleagues to the left, expressing thanks to Senator Bryan and especially Senator Q-Tub for the extensive hard work they put into this, and again to Senator Q-Tub for agreeing to include in her Dash 12 Section 23, which is the open meeting provision. I'm going to pass out letter which I'm authorized to distribute today in support of Section 23 from the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I think you also heard at the beginning of this an unsolicited endorsement of it from one of the advocacy groups. And I believe you also have letters from other advocacy groups in support of this provision. This in response to the statement that this merely reflects the very narrow interests of a very narrow group. I think the record belies that. This is an important amendment in that while 99% of the advisory groups to the Oregon Health Plan are open to the public, there is at least one major exception, and that is the Formulary Advisory Subcommittee of the Medical Directors Advisory Committee. This is a group that is engaged in very serious deliberations that could affect the scope of benefit, level of benefit to Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries, and more seriously, or equally seriously, could raise some very serious antitrust issues under both the federal and state civil and criminal antitrust laws. We think that both in terms of a good government change and in terms of enhanced law enforcement and antitrust compliance, this is a very important amendment.
Thank you very much. Seems like a awesome committee. We're in a subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to add, this is the first time I've been to the left of Mr. Gardner.
Okay. Kim and Mary Lou and Enrich. Please. Be brief. We
will.
Run out of time.
Mr. Chairman,
My name's Ian Kim. I'm the director of the Oregon Primary Care Association, a small nonprofit association's community-based safety net clinic that specializes in serving farm workers, the homeless, low-income, uninsured people around Oregon. And I just wanted to make a few comments on the Dash 12 amendments as I got them today. The requirement for 6-month reports on the copayment would be particularly burdensome for the safety net clinics. These clinics now are pretty stretched for funds. More than half of their patients are uninsured as it is now. And so to create more paperwork reporting, computer programming, and tracking all these $2 copayments to turn in a report every 6 months would just take away resources that they are now so stretched, or that they have to turn away patients who have no other place for access or recommend they go to the emergency room. So it's going to be a hardship for some of the low crawlers in the health delivery system. And the provisions on the application paperwork requirements will create more barriers to enrollment and in effect reduce enrollment, and those will be particularly burdensome for people with mental illness, Alzheimer's, the homeless, people with low literacy or low educational ability. And so it sort of keeps shuffling some people away from the insurance coverage and the managed care which they need or their children need. And there were some studies that showed that the Oregon Health Plan had been quite successful in reducing the rising premium rates on private insurance in Oregon. And this was done by reducing the cost shifting that was so endemic before the Oregon Health Plan was adopted. And so from our view, creating more barriers to getting through the paperwork for people who would be eligible and the assumed beneficiaries of the program will force those people back into the safety net clinics or the emergency rooms. And the safety net clinics don't really have capacity to absorb more uninsured, and in fact, the number of uninsured seeking care has been increasing in the past year. So I'm concerned that some of these may have the unintended impact of shifting costs back because people aren't getting the preventive or the appropriate access to care. We're concerned about eliminating the dental services, and while we recognize that it is an optional service for adults, there was a lot of public testimony and a number of studies that show that access to dental care is the number one health problem in Oregon. And those led to its inclusion in the original Oregon Health Plan. There's also the potential liability of the public belief that the tobacco tax was passed to maintain the Oregon Health Plan. And so this would have a pretty high profile with the public as an obvious cutback and something they thought that they had provided funds for. And then finally, Section 20, the prohibition of spending the state money on services not receiving federal match, as Senator Bryant mentioned, is designed to stop paying for the cost of abortion. And I want to point out that this is unlikely to save any money, and it will create access, a barrier to access to this service for especially low-income women. And this may have the effect of cutting off their options to improve their lives or the lives of their existing family by educational advancement or job opportunities. So I'm concerned that I agree with Senator Bryant that should be separated out and dealt with separately. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Quickly, my name is Mary Lou Henrich. I am the CEO of Care Oregon, one of the Oregon Health Plan contractors, and actually about 75% of our network providers are the safety net clinics that Mr. Kim represents. So I won't go into the issues around the safety net and how many, some of these amendments really will have an adverse reaction to them and their ability to continue to serve that large number of uninsured, which still do exist out there. I mean, truly, they are there. My written testimony, I give, a few cleanup things that where there's some lack of clarity, and I also was on the Dash 10 amendments because I didn't have the 12. But as I looked at the 12, there still is some of that unclarity about, if you're talking about healthcare providers being the physicians and nurse practitioners who serve the patient, or if you're talking about the fully capitated health plan. And I suggest some language. I think you're really talking, you're talking about the fully capitated plans or the prepaid health plans. And so I have some of those little minor things written in my testimony. The several bigger things. One is the issue about the homeless and mentally ill. That really is a problem. And I think having some kind of way that someone else can attest to that the person is a resident, whether it's a shelter person who, or someone in the mental health agency, something like that for the people who have difficulty getting those things together and don't have all the documentation, or they probably wouldn't be in the situation they are. So that would be, that would be spoken to. I would support doing something like that. The other is the issue of cutting dental. I would just second all the things that you've heard about that, but I think it is really poor policy to do it. It will increase the cost on the medical side, and then you'll start seeing the increases in those rates, and so I really think much of it is very self-defeating, and the issue of people getting off welfare to work in the service industry. I strongly believe that's true. The issue on the Dash 15 amendment, which I hadn't seen until I came down today, I strongly support what Amy Malone said from the Providence Health Plan. As chair of the contractors group, and Amy is the incoming vice chair of that group, we have worked very closely with OMAP to work out what is, I think, a reasonable compromise that won't end up causing unreasonable delays on a lot of things that actually contractors would be in support of having happen, some changes in the contract. And I think that we've worked out something. I think 15 is unnecessary. I think it really maybe pushed everybody to get to the point where we reached the compromises, but I think the majority of the plans believe that 15 really isn't necessary. I think there are a couple of plans that don't agree with that, and we never have total unanimity, but that's one. And the other is I also support the Dash 8 amendment if it is trying to get people to be able to go to providers outside of the plan. I think that the contractors as a whole would very much not want that to happen, because it is just setting up unmanaged, kind of chaotic care again. The issue on copays, from Care Oregon's point of view, we are not a fan of copays because we believe that these people are very low income. If we were talking people between 100 and 200% of poverty, but the majority of the people that this is hitting are people under 100% of poverty. And people are already paying, many of them, some type of premium, and that it just keeps people from coming in and getting the routine care and then forcing the costs up because they end up with things that have been unattended. So we're just not a big fan of that.
Thank you very much. Questions? I believe we've gotten to the end of our witness list. Is that right? We are not going to try to solve this issue today. We're going to set it over. We're going to post a work session for 3:30 tomorrow. And we will, at that time, probably be taking some additional amendments, potentially. We will hopefully have a full committee then so we can actually act on a measure. And so, with that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2700, and I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 3632. And Vice Representative, Representative Welch. Please keep the noise down, and we'll have Representative Welch and Senator up down that way.
George.
Public hearing. Senator George's Representative Wells, tell us about 3632.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's our biennial bill for the age change difference here for a right to ride a motorcycle without a helmet by an adult. We have had the hearing in two committees on the House side. It didn't pass on one, so they had another vehicle to run the bill out. And we had it in House Water Environment, pass it out, and pass on the floor. So we have proven one thing, that certainly this issue can pass in the Senate, because it already did in the Senate bill, and it can pass as a House bill. We do have the votes, and this certainly this legislature has said that those who are 21 years of age and older are adults, so they can make a decision not to wear a helmet or to wear it. And we have identified this bill on the floor as an issue of personal responsibility and freedom. We have a choice. The government regulates and has a tendency to over-regulate. And we would like to be able to make the decision on type of equipment we would like to wear for our safety. When you look at some of the helmets out there and the standards or lack of them, you understand that and some of the studies that don't talk about accidents from the head down, neck and spine. And honestly, you're not very protected out there in a motorcycle to begin with. And I would always want to wear my helmet and leathers and be sensible about every kind of safety equipment possible on a motorcycle. And I've owned motorcycles and ridden them, and I wore a helmet. But I want to make that decision what safety equipment is necessary. And this bill is just one of those that we feel that when we are of adult age, we can make those decisions. And that is what the bill does. And you don't need any more testimony from me. We passed it on the House side. And it was nonpartisan. We had great testimony from both sides of the aisle on this. And it had a lot to do with the personal responsibility, freedom aspect of regulation for personal safety. Thank you.
Yeah, may I just ask a
quick
question? Yes. Okay. What happened to our bill? I forgot.
It went over in Transportation Committee to not have the votes come out.
Okay, thank
we
you.
We had cool. Another vehicle and... And the House bill real quick and pass.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State Senator Gary George, District 2. I could echo the ideas of freedom. I had an article here just a minute ago I was looking at from, I believe, the Albany Democrat Herald, talking about motorcycle freedom. And it hasn't been many years ago as we first started looking at the idea of socialized medicine in this country, and that's what it was called, rightfully so back then. Many of us raised the concern that when government is then going to become responsible for your treatment of your medical conditions, that they will probably then begin to infringe upon your freedoms, telling you we don't want you to smoke, we don't want you to drink, and we don't want you to ride motorcycles or anything other things like that. And one of the things I want to raise today, if I could, Mr. Chairman, is the idea that we have scenarios that we've already taken extensive restrictive action upon. And many of you, the senators that are here, remember the number 68,000 teenagers who died in the last 10 years. The interesting thing about that is that 40,800 of those teenagers were not wearing seat belts, yet every state requires seat belts to be worn. And I think, as Representative Welsh just pointed out, that what is needed is the training. And we have a program in Oregon that I'm going to be just real soon, as soon as we get out of this session, maybe that's not quite so soon, but I'm going to be taking this course. And, you know, one of the things I found interesting is a lot of the literature that they gave me talks about wearing motorcycle helmets. And, you know, I'm going to tell you folks. Representative just described a situation where he would wear leathers and he would wear a helmet. But that would be his decision to make. And I saw some young people just this weekend flying down the highway on one of these really low, fast bikes, absolutely bare-legged. And, you know, it doesn't take much to imagine what that person would look like if they hit the pavement. What he needed right there is not a helmet law, because he was wearing the helmet, but was some training on what happens in the way of an accident. The key to motorcycle safety is not a helmet or even the leathers, but avoiding the accident. That is training to drive defensively. It would be nice if we could encourage people to be thoughtful to the fact that there are other people on other kinds of vehicles, namely motorcycles, and that they should be careful about them. But one of the things I hope every one of you remember, and then I will be quiet here, is the comparison in 1993, which is the last dates that we had available on this, for motorcycle accident statistics. In the voluntary helmet states, 2.90 deaths per 100 accidents. But in the states where it was mandatory, it was 2.98. The point about a motorcycle accident is don't have the accident. Now, our folks here, the motorcycle operators in this state, have, I think, done an outstanding job of stepping up to the plate, and they're saying, look, what we need to do is keep from having a motorcycle accident. They've done that. But a couple of things, but then I'll finish up here. I'd like you to remember, 550 people died in automobiles, 260 people in falls, 180 people from medicines, drugs, and poisonings, 75 people bicycles and pedestrians, 47 drowning, 30 in the complications from medical procedures, 28 from suffocations, food, and other, 27 motorcycle, estimated 3 non-helmet. This is really a minor thing. But it is part of the culture of this country that we do have something called liberty. And part of liberty is, I'm 21, I'll make my own decisions, thank you. And I would really think we would send a nice message to people that we really respect the fact that you're going to act responsibly. And even if you don't, we really think that's your decision. We'd like you to be informed. But, one of the things I think we need to have basic training today in the legislature is understand what our Constitution or Bill of Rights say. And they're very clear about personal liberty, and I think we need to honor that, and thank you for the time.
Question? Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Starr, committee members. I'm Bill Fisher, Senator from District 23. I just am not going to take a lot of your time, but I just wanted to add my support to this bill and would appreciate being allowed to ride my motorcycle without a helmet. For years I didn't ride because of the helmet law, rode off-road and on my own property and things like that, but did not ride on the highway. And I guess I would probably have to declare a potential conflict of interest now that I'm the owner of a road bike and riding on the road, but to me, that's part and parcel of the enjoyment of riding. Is not have to be bound down with a helmet. It maybe isn't so bad in the winter months and colder weather and things like that, but it's a pretty sweaty piece of equipment now that the weather's getting warm and nice. And it also, in my estimate, does increase certain injuries if you don't happen to hit your head in an accident. You have the extra weight of the helmet on your neck, and there's some indication that that can be a bit disabling also. And I know that the statistics show that there was 27 deaths from motorcycle accidents. What it doesn't show, and is estimated that the three of them weren't wearing helmets, I don't know why they would estimate. They should either know or not know. If somebody winds up in a Blue Hill, if they've got a helmet on or don't have a helmet on, but in any event, to me, they're not showing how many of them would have died anyway, regardless of whether they had a helmet or not. And so, if only three people are dying that aren't wearing helmets, I don't know how many bootleg or what, but I see that they get caught every now and then for not wearing a helmet or not having a proper helmet. It obviously is not adding much to the statistics. So I would just urge your support of this bill and would hope that somewhere or another we can talk the governor into having a little bit of courage to sign one of these one of these days.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
I wonder if either you gentlemen ever ran into a small bees on a bike without a helmet. Yeah. The difference between with a helmet and without one. You hit a small bees because I have.
I Senator Fisher. I have not personally ever done it, but I rode twice years ago for years without a helmet or without goggles, and without a windshield. And I took a grasshopper or something one time in the forehead. It was a bit of a shock, but maybe I beat the law of averages. My first cousin, though, had an old 650, a 1960s 650 BSA, and was chasing a watermelon thief that had stolen a watermelon from his property, doing over 100, and went through a flock of bees with no shirt on or a helmet. And he came out a little bit the worse for wear, but I don't think it influenced him to change his riding habits.
I'm sure the point I was trying to make is that when you're on bees with a helmet on, and it's not a full face, if you need to get inside that helmet real fast, real quick.
I thought maybe you were headed towards the area, State Senator Gary George, of the idea of the happy biker, but you can tell them by the bugs on your teeth. But you're absolutely right, and that is the condition. And I've had them, they normally hit your face. If you're wearing a pair of glasses, you're in good shape. And if you rode a motorcycle without any kind of glasses, I don't know what to tell you, hopefully a shield in front. But the point of it is that's a possibility. And when you said that, I thought about one time in an airplane, I lifted off and was at about 8,000 feet when it got warm enough in the cockpit that the bees who had made themselves a home earlier decided to come into the cockpit with me. And the one thing I wished I could have done was not to have the cockpit around me, kind of like the helmet on your describing on your motorcycle, but I could have gotten rid of them a little bit faster than I did. So anyway, I think there again, responsible conduct. I don't know, I had a swarm of bees fall off of a limb in an orchard in my lap, and I can tell you that encounter is not one that you want to readily remember anyway, and you will modify your procedures following that experience.
Thank you.
I just want to say I'd be more worried about the drivers up there chewing snoop of the bees.
Why would you be worried about that?
Because my dad chewed snoop, and I sat in the back seat. And the window was down.
Okay. I played football in West Virginia, and the other team used to chew, and I won't say what they did with the juice that they used to chew.
Right. I don't know what about it.
Let us not go there, folks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
sir. Far loose control here. Would we have Scott Marmar and Troy Costello? Please come forward.
Out in the hall, if somebody wants.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Lawrence. I'm a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police, and I'm the lead instructor with the Oregon State Police Motorcycle Unit in Salem. I've been with the Motors Unit for the past 5 years, and the Oregon State Police are in opposition of House Bill 3632. For your convenience, I've attached a copy of my written testimony that I presented before the Senate Transportation Committee on March 3rd on Senate Bill 583. Since our rationale has remained unchanged, I will not repeat the testimony from March 3rd. The only thing that I can add to my original testimony to support our position for the effectiveness of motorcycle helmets is the Department's internal policy on safety. We have made safety our number one priority and have invested heavily in many ways, including research, training, and equipment. We believe that helmets led to the fatigue or were otherwise detrimental to the safety of our own people. I would be here as a champion of House Bill 3632. State police are certainly not alone in the law enforcement community, and our internal policies on helmets based on their safety effectiveness. In addition to our internal position, our role in transportation and safety community certainly makes us advocates of those things that serve to reduce the amount of severity of crash-related injuries. Since we believe strongly in the effectiveness of motorcycle helmets, we also believe that they should be required for all riders of motorcycles and mopeds. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point.
Thank you very much. You heard the testimony of the senator that avoiding accidents is probably more important than the equipment you were wearing.
That's one of them, yes. avoiding accidents. But how do you avoid an accident when somebody doesn't see you? And that's another point.
I understand. Any further questions?
I'm
a witness to testify, and then I want to make a statement.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Casales. I'm the Transportation Safety Division Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. ODOT is opposed to House Bill 3632. I'd like to make four quick points. First, on page 3 of my testimony, presented to you a chart of fatalities from 1975 through 1997, separating each year into three different categories. As you'll note, running through that continuum, motorcycle fatalities that had a helmet on has consistently from year to year been between 15 and 30 fatalities, and that's the lower gray area. Second, notice in the years when we had no helmet law from 1977 through 1987, you'll see the black area, which is fatalities where there is no helmet. During the years without a law, we were anywhere between 20 and 45 fatalities during those years. And then the years where we did have a law, the black area on this chart is anywhere between 3 and 5. I would expect that if the helmet law was repealed, that we would see anywhere from 15 to 25 more fatalities on motorcycles, similar to what we saw between the years of 1977 through 1987. In 1988, the voters of Oregon showed very strong support for this law. They overwhelmingly approved this the helmet law by a 2-to-1 margin, and that vote passed in every county of the state. Fourth point, the very last chart in your packet, which is the line drawing, again, going from 1975 through 1998. This particular chart is breaking the fatalities up by age, and we'd like to look at the very last point in 1998. We had, for the first time in our recorded history, no motorcycle fatalities under the age of 21. Yet this is the age in which the law is saying to not repeal the law for under 21, yet all of the fatalities in 1998 were above the age of 21. Lastly, for me, when looking at this particular bill, we had a very impressive show of support just recently on the team licensing bill. And part of the testimony and estimates on that bill, we would see anywhere from 8 to 10 fewer fatalities for our teenagers. Yet when we apply the same logic to this particular bill, we would expect to see 15 to 25 more fatalities in the motorcycling community. And in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to again let you know that ODOT is opposed to this bill and request a no vote on House Bill 3632. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? We have no more questions, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for closing. Preparing, open the work session. House Bill 3632.
Okay. I move House Bill 3632 to the floor. There aren't any amendments, are there? To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shannon has moved House Bill 3632 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes. You know, I've been voting against this bill since D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I will continue to vote against this bill. Not that it's going to influence anybody here. Everybody knows what's going to happen to this bill. But even, you know what's going to happen, right? We all know what's going to happen to the bill. The bill is going to be vetoed.
I can't imagine that.
Yeah. I just...
One of these days, we're going to get this bill passed.
Well, you know, I tell you what we should do then, although I would never support this. Let's do it. You should get rid of helmets for kids on bikes. You should get rid of the seatbelt law. We should make sure that airplanes, you don't have to, they have no right to require us to wear seatbelts in airplanes. You know, it's just the most amazing thing to me that we've chosen the motorcycle helmet to say is the greatest invasion of individual freedom, an invasion of one's right to decide for him or herself. And, you know, I haven't made any friends on this, you can imagine, Mr. Chair. I can think of a certain guy who has an ideal lawn sign location to put up 5,000 lawn signs of my opponent last time around simply because of my vote on this. I just, whether it's because the voters voted in or the safety records or whatever you want to say, I just think there's 1,000 reasons to just say what the public did on this, you should leave alone and not mess with it. So I know you got the votes. I'm a no here, and I'll be a no on the floor, and I don't know whether I'll give a speech anymore because I'm getting tired of giving my speech, which no one listens to. But, Well, you know, I tell you,
I really, really, really appreciate the good testimony on this, and I bought the motorcycle for my boys to do the irrigation with, and they liked it so well when they got old enough, they bought their own bikes, and the older they got, the bigger the bikes got, and the older son, when he got off to college, he got a big all over the West Coast, and one day he was after working all day at the farm, he got on the bike about 3 o'clock to go to the swing tip cannery. 2 miles from home he went to sleep riding a bike. And when he laid that bike down, the lady driving behind him didn't think he had a chance. But he went 70 feet across that pavement on his head. And the hole in that helmet was as big as a hen's egg. But it never touched his head. And he never rode the bike again. It was the cheapest accident he ever had. But I am supporting this bill. And we've got... They'll move
Either the society, we are moving. When I worked heavy construction in the 60s, my first 2 summers, we didn't wear a hard hat. My last summer, we wore hard hats. We're moving to the point where downhill skiing people will wear some kind of headgear. We watched in the game of hockey headgear. I'm very serious about this. We are increasingly as a society moving to headgears in athletics in the work area. And I'm very sincere about this. We're not going the other way.
Are downhill skiers required or mandated to wear?
Well, I'll tell you what. They're not required yet.
Right.
But you mark my words. You mark my words. In the Olympics, you watch. In the Olympics, at least, you will watch. At some time, you will watch. There will be restrictions on that kind of thing in terms of downhill skiing. I mean, I realize you're going to use that on me, the argument on me. I suggest it is coming somewhere.
Oh, it's water skiers.
Well,
let's go. Let's go.
Every time.
We'll
be.
All right.
Courtney votes no. Again and again.
Aye. My name is Steve. And that's Terry McGregor, House Bill 3632 moves the floor to do pass recommendations. Senator Starr will carry.
Yeah,
that's a better idea.
Yeah.
We will have Senator George and Senator Fisher will carry this bill.
And I will probably speak again and move